third category of rights we're developing is what we call transformative rights. I think this is where it gets really exciting. So let's say you want to take a book and you want to use AI to transform it into a children's book or transform it into a short video, or you want to take the style of the author's voice and write new books with their voice, or you want to take a book and personalize it for you. I mean, there's this whole world of stuff that can be done that combines AI and copyrighted content. And there's right now just no legal framework to make that possible.
Actually, I really like that. I'm curious now, like, if I could put myself into a Dostoevsky novel, I guess that's probably not copyright protected, but you know what I mean? Put my daughters into a Harry Potter book or whatever and see what would come out the other end. That's really fun, actually.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Gusto. Gusto is easy online payroll, benefits, and HR built for modern small businesses. Get 3 months free when you run your first payroll at gusto.com/twist. NetSuite, the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, giving you one source of truth. Download the CFO's Guide to AI and Machine Learning for free at netsuite.com/twist. And Horatio, customer experience can make or break your business. Horatio provides top-tier outsourcing solutions to support and delight your customers so you can focus on growth. Visit horatio.com/twist and get $2,000 off your initial setup.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Twist. My name is Alex. This is This Week in Startups. And Jason, my co-host, is out sick, so I am taking point today. We have an absolutely incredible interview coming up in just a few minutes. But before we do that, I want to hit on two news topics that I think are very, very important. So, number one, Mistral, the French company that is known for its work in the realm of AI models, has told the media that it does intend to pursue an IPO in time. Now, that's not an enormous shock because, well, we presume that all major AI model companies will list, at least at some point in the future. But what this does do is set up a little bit of a fun parlor game for us. So who do you think is going to go out first? Will it be OpenAI or Anthropic, which is doing quite well? XAI, which raised a lot of money this year, or Mistral? I actually kind of wonder if the French company is going to beat the American companies to listing on the domestic exchanges because, well, I think it probably needs the money. That's something I can't wait to see unfold this year as we unpack what 2025 will bring to us in the realm of AI. And one of those things that is for sure going to happen is more capital. Anthropic, which we just mentioned, is raising another $1 billion from Alphabet. Recall, of course, that Amazon has also put a lot of money into the company, and the Anthropic is working on raising $2 billion more from venture capitalists. So quite a lot of funds for a company that not everyone puts in the top tier, but I think absolutely deserves a seat at the front of the AI table. The biggest thing that's going on today, and I'm sure everyone's heard of this by now, is Project Stargate. And this is a $500 billion net project that was announced with President Trump, Sam Altman, I think Larry Ellison was there, and Masa Sun from SoftBank. The gist is that there's going to be a new company called Project Stargate that will start with $100 billion to build out infra that's going to support OpenAI and its development. Now, you were thinking, Microsoft, what about them? Well, Microsoft will no longer now be the exclusive cloud provider of OpenAI, but they will retain right of first refusal, and they have longstanding commercial agreements with OpenAI. That means that the Microsoft OpenAI partnership is not broken, but it's certainly a little bit diminished now that this new product has come online. So just give you a quick rundown of who the individual players are in this and what to expect from them. OpenAI is doing equity funding, and they're the lead partner on operational responsibility for the project, and they are, quote, a key initial technology provider. SoftBank is doing equity funding, and they're going to be the lead partner on the financial side. Then you have Oracle, which is putting money in and also got key to initial technology partner. Then you have Arm, NVIDIA, and Microsoft, tech partners, and then money from MGX, which is an Abu Dhabi-based AI investment vehicle that claimed a $100 billion mandate, though, of course, we don't expect all of that money to wind up in Project Stargate's coffers. So how much of this is kind of real is the question. Whenever you see a headline number like $500 billion over time, it's good to sit back and go, okay, that's the pledge. What will actually happen? And we've seen this with a Foxconn plant. I think it was in Wisconsin. Questions about how chip money will get spent and so forth. Headline numbers always need to be vetted to make sure they comport with reality. And there's been a lot of people, including Elon Musk and Gavin Baker, who have been casting a little bit of doubt on these numbers. But the market is not that concerned. Today, before we jumped on live, Arm stock, part of the overall package of companies, is up about 18%. NVIDIA's up 4%, SoftBank gained 10%, Oracle was up 7.2%, and Microsoft gained about 3.4%. So clearly the public markets think that this is both real and happening as promised. There was a little bit of interesting nuance in having a senior White House advisor the next day after a major White House announcement, casting a little bit of doubt on it. But I think we can just kind of file that under the politics in 2025 are going to be very, very different than what we had seen in the preceding eras. So if you were expecting this to look like, I don't know, what we saw under Trump 1 or Obama 2 or Biden's administration, stop thinking that way. It's all going to be done live. It'll all be done on Twitter. And there's going to be a lot more, I think, internecine conflicts, even if that does lead to a secondary kind of like slew of headlines that might not be what the White House wants. Well, this is the way things currently work. Now, on the front of money, ARM Holding CEO Rene Haas did say that they're still working out the financial details. That's a public comment. So clearly, I think the back half, the $400 billion that's not in the first $100 billion tranche is being sorted out. But if there's any group of people out there who could put together this kind of capital for a project, Sam Altman's famous for his deal making. Masa Sun and SoftBank have done some of the biggest investment vehicles in the history of investment, as far as I can recall. Don't forget, Vision Fund 1 and 2 were ambitious, but Masa likes to do more and go higher. Larry Ellison, of course, wants to make sure that Oracle has a big place at the cloud and AI table. There's a lot of money, a lot of market cap here. And so I'm less skeptical that the money won't become apparent. But the nice thing is, Sam Altman and OpenAI said very specifically that the first $100 billion is being put to work now. So we're going to be able to tell, and probably pretty quickly, if this is hype or if this is substance. All we need is to see the shovels and the dirt, the cables being laid, pick your construction-based analogy, but we're going to be able to vet this. So all the chatter right now is just kind of that. It's just chewing on it. We're going to be able to actually go to the sites and see. So who wins here? Well, clearly OpenAI does. I mean, they now have an enormous project, essentially presidential backing and more capital to go out there and build the stuff that they want to basically support their own AI work. Good job. Well done, Sam. I think NVIDIA and ARM, also part of this overall package, they're going to sell some chips. Good for them. Not that they were struggling with demand, but it never hurts to be name checked in a project of this size with this level of, I think, national security context, let alone economic context. SoftBank, Masa loves podium time. He was once again up there with Trump in front of the podium, talking his book. There's nothing he loves more than doing deals and getting publicity. And he's doing a huge deal with a lot of publicity. So I'm sure he's happy. SoftBank investors, probably happy. After all, if you don't like Masa, would you really hold SoftBank stock at this point in time? Oracle definitely did well here. And I think MGX, that Abu Dhabi-based investment fund, I think this is pretty good for them. Because it means they're getting allocation into, as we said, a national security critical deal. And there has been questions about G42 and just how AI in the Middle East will sit in the broader China-US AI dominance conflict. So I think this is a pretty big win for them. The loser side of the coin is pretty clear. Microsoft, no longer the exclusive cloud provider of OpenAI. OpenAI did say they're going to use more Azure. They're going to spend more with Microsoft. Okay. But this definitely feels like a slight pivot away from the absolute bromance of Satya and Sam. So I'm going to put them in the loser column very loosely. And Frank Shaw, if you're watching this, please don't yell at me. And then the other group in the loser column, I think it's just OpenAI's competitors. If you are Anthropic or XAI or Mistral, it probably doesn't feel great to watch your arch rival get this amount of publicity and capital and access to compute, especially if you're scrambling for compute, as we've seen Anthropic recently say. Now, Anthropic's revenue grew, I think it was 10x last year. So they're doing very, very well, but they're still a little bit constrained on this straight up GPU side. So this is going to ensure that OpenAI isn't. So if you are a competitor to them, I don't think this is your favorite day, unless you can lever this to get more money from your existing backers. Back at the top of the show, we talked about how Anthropic is raising more money. Well, I wonder if this is not a catalyst in that direction. Just to go ahead and kind of like close this off, we heard about this project a little bit before. So back in April, there was rumors that OpenAI and Microsoft were putting together a $100 billion computer. Okay, we all said at the time, sure, Sam Altman's out there talking about how he needs trillions of dollars, so why not? But that was called Project Stargate. So now we're seeing Project Stargate again, but with some extra stuff brought into it. and then handed to the new president essentially as a thing for him to announce as a shiny object. But just keep in mind that this is not something that was put together in the last 2 days, let alone since the election. This has been an extension of an ongoing project, but I don't think that we should give the new president too much credit, if that makes sense.
All right, you didn't start your company to run payroll, did you? Of course not. We all know that. Gusto is here to help. Gusto is going to help you run your payroll and handle all your benefits, onboarding, and HR all in one place. The market agrees. 300,000 businesses trust Gusto today, and you can too. As your startup scales, Gusto is going to grow with you. You got state and federal taxes handled for your staff around the country. Gusto does all that. And hey, maybe it's finally time for you to offer a 401k plan for your team, right? Gusto's got you on that. And you might need to get your compliance sorted, right? Well, 3 out of 4 employers say Gusto helps them be government compliant. And even better, Gusto is simple, easy to use software. So you can focus on what matters, building your startup. So here's your quick call to action. Do you want all Gusto has to offer with no hidden fees? Well, how about a discount? Try Gusto and get 3 months free. Gusto.com/twist. That's GUSTO.com/twist.
So that's the big money news here on Wednesday. Now, let's talk to our guest. There's a really cool company out there called Scribd. You may have heard of it. Well, its founder has a second project. It's called Created by Humans. And I want to welcome Trip Adler to Twist. Trip, hey, how you doing?
Hey, it's great. Great to be here today.
Good, man. So I am a big fan of books. I am a big fan of AI, and I am a writer by trade, which means that your company is at the absolute intersection of all of my interests. Because awesome. Trip, as I understand it, you are building a platform that allows people who have written books to license that IP to AI model companies. Yeah?
Yeah, that is what we're doing. This issue of how copyright works in an AI world is a very messy, complicated issue, and there's a lot of conflict around it. And at Created by Humans, we are trying to solve this problem once and for all. And we're doing this by building a marketplace for AI rights for content. We're starting with books because we think books are really important. There's a lot of things to be solved, and then we're going to expand other kinds of content from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I was going back and prepping for this. You guys raised $5 million last year. That hit a big press cycle, but you hadn't launched yet. But in fact, I think in the last week, the platform has actually come online. So my first question to you, of course, is, how has the first week gone?
Yeah, it's going great. So we announced the company in June of last year, got to work on building the product, built out the team, and then the product went live last week. And we have had a terrific response from authors. We are now getting a new book being AI licensed about once every 5 minutes, which, you know, considering that, you know, just a few months ago, there was pretty much zero activity in AI licensing for books. We think that's a major step forward. And we're really just getting started. I mean, this is just the very beginning. We expect this to really kind of pick up as we bring more pieces of this together. So yeah, we're off to a really great start, raising more funding and just have a lot of momentum. It's a lot of fun.
So I know you guys had Walter Isaacson as kind of a founding author, but I'm curious how many total books are now available on the platform today. I know it's growing very quickly, but I'm just curious if it's dozens, hundreds, thousands, or whatever the number is.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely in the thousands. We haven't put a number out yet. I mean, we're a brand new company. We're just getting started. But, you know, we aspire to pretty soon have, you know, millions of books all available for AI purposes. And we want, when AI companies need books for training, for RAG, for whatever use cases, rather than using these pirated services, we hope they just come to us and they get legitimate licenses for these books. And we want this to kind of be a shared resource that the whole AI world can use, and just sort of reset this dynamic between human creators and AI companies.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great idea. And as someone who's written, you know, honestly, let's be honest, millions of words online, I too would love to have some sort of, I don't know, recompense from all that being ingested. But one thing I'm really curious about is the price point. So very recently, today actually, Ashley Vance, who is a writer over at Bloomberg, shared this tweet, which I know is a little bit small, so I'm going to explain to everyone watching the live stream. The tweet says, "What you think, guys? $2,500 to have one of my books sucked into an LLM, yes or no?" This was a HarperCollins deal with some unknown tech company offering that amount of money. And he was collecting, you know, feedback from his audience. And I'm curious how much work needs to be done to smooth over tensions between AI model companies and authors and publishers? Because it feels like there's a lot of bad blood. And so authors who might be skeptical, how are you going out there and reaching them and getting them to say, okay, I'm willing to try this. I'm not going to get burned by new tech.
Well, I think that what we want to do is both solve the licensing problem and the protection problem. So we're going to create the tools that will allow these books to be easily licensed, which right now is very difficult to do just because the rights are so complicated. And then also we're going to be building tools that allow monitoring of the services to make sure they're being used appropriately. So you kind of need a third party here to sort of manage the relationship. And in terms of like how this is priced, I mean, that's what you need to figure out right now. I mean, there's one perspective out there, which is that, you know, human data is the most valuable resource in the world, and it should be at this extremely high price. The other perspective is that all human data should be free and all training should be free. We think the answer is somewhere in the middle. And this company is going to find that market price. I mean, that's what we're trying to do. So I don't know what it's going to be yet. I mean, $2,500 a book, that was kind of one of the first AI licensing deals done in the book space. That was between HarperCollins and Microsoft. That was in the press. You know, we think there's going to be a lot more of these kinds of deals. And I think one of the keys here is that we think there's going to be potentially many AI licensing deals. I mean, there could be hundreds of AI companies licensing books in the future. So even if each deal is relatively smaller, what an author would like to see, if you add that up across many, many AI deals, the numbers could get really, really big.
So essentially, the pitch to authors is, sure, some folks are worried about AI eating human creativity, but let's be honest, we're going towards an AI future. Don't you want to have your books have the best possible chance at monetization in this new era? That to me is a very compelling pitch because I am a capitalist. But I'm curious, has anyone complained about what you guys are doing? I like it, but not everyone is as technology forward as you and I are.
I mean, everyone's pretty positive what we're doing. I mean, we're kind of building a bridge here that makes sort of everyone happy. And for authors, we have both licensing and copyright protection. So
yeah.
If you want to just put your books up and not license them, we do that too. So it kind of works for everyone. So we're getting a pretty good reaction overall. On AI, it's very mixed with authors. I mean, you have some authors who are concerned about it, worried about it. You have some who are really enthusiastic. And we're right now focused on the most enthusiastic ones. I mean, when I started pitching this to a few authors I knew, I texted it to Walter Isaacson. I just texted him a pitch deck and said, I knew him from my Scrib days. And I just said, hey, what do you think? You want to get involved? And he got back to me in like 5 or 10 minutes and was just ecstatic about this idea. I just really want to get involved. Within like a day or so, we had signed him up to be involved, and now we're working closely with him. So there's definitely authors like that who are really enthusiastic. So Walter then led to Doug Preston getting on board, mm-hmm. which led to Susan Orlin, which led to Sylvia Day. And it's just kind of it's sort of like the movement is growing.
Yeah, and you guys said that when you emerged from beta, you had the support of quote over 50 best-selling authors. So definitely some folks are showing up. Now, the other side of the marketplace is, of course, AI companies, the big model companies and so forth. We've seen a lot of deals between, OpenAI and Axios recently. There's been a lot of individual kind of one-offs signed between major companies and model companies. Do you think that they're going to be, very excited to engage with what Created by Humans is putting together? I'm not sure how much the demand is ready for this. And I'm curious if you could just tell me, like, what have you heard from AI companies regarding what you have on offer?
So yeah, I mean, we've been in conversations with most of them at multiple levels in the org, and overall, I think folks are really excited. I think that they're not happy with all these lawsuits and all these perception issues with creators.
Yeah,
and they want to solve it. They also want to get more data. They're trying to scale their data acquisition efforts, and right now they're doing it through these big deals that involve like, with large media companies, lots of lawyers. The idea that we can just make it plug and play for them, I mean, that's really exciting for them too. So overall, it's been really positive. And we're just getting started, so we'll see where it goes. But yeah, it really feels like the market is kind of pulling this sort of product into existence.
I definitely think so. And for full transparency, I talked to the folks from Tollbit last year. They're doing it seems more kind of like web content versus books as their initial focus. But they also described a similar sentiment that there's going to be an absolute need for this. So let's go build what everyone needs and solve some of these tensions. How do you guys handle essentially copyright? Because I know that authors have copyright, publishers probably have some sort of play in that. Do you often end up having to help negotiate that sort of licensing side of things? Or is that kind of off your plate and that lands more on the author's lap when they come to work with you?
The less your business spends on operations, multiple systems, and on delivering your product and service, the more margin you have, the more money you keep, right? You want to get fit in this new era here in Silicon Valley and in tech broadly. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, of course, everything is costing more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, giving you one source of truth. With NetSuite, you're going to reduce your IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud and it can be accessed from anywhere. This means you cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems with one unified business management suite, and you improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and time-consuming errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math to see how you'll profit with NetSuite. So here's your call to action. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible finance program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/twist. That's netsuite.com/twist.
Well, we think that we're gonna solve copyright by creating the shared resource of content that's available for license with all the appropriate licenses in place. You know, we actually have different categories of AI rights. So we started thinking of this mostly for training, and we built rights to allow copyright content for training. But we realized another big type of license is for what we call reference rights, which is basically a license for using content for RAG. So let's say you're writing a prompt, you want some information, and the answer is on page 293 of a book.
Yeah.
We have a reference license would allow you to access that information. And then the third category of rights we're developing is what we call transformative rights. I think this is where it gets really exciting. So let's say you want to take a book and you want to use AI to transform it into a children's book or transform it into a short video, or you want to take the style of the author's voice and write new books with their voice, or you want to take a book and personalize it for you. I mean, there's this whole world of stuff that can be done that combines AI and copyrighted content. And there's right now just no legal framework to make that possible. So we're building both the legal framework and sort of like the product and the repository of content to kind of unlock this opportunity.
All right. So there's three levels here. One is information for AI model training, the thing that everyone kind of understands when we think about this type of deal. The other one is RAG, effectively. How do you improve how AI models work when they need other information? Love that. And then the third one, super crazy, transformative. I didn't know you were doing that. And I can see how some people would be worried about that. But then again, when you take someone's IP and make a video out of it, you're doing a transformation. So this sort of IP use is not novel, even if the technology use case is. Okay. Yeah. Actually, I really like that. I'm curious now, like, if I could put myself into a Dostoevsky novel, I guess that's probably not copyright protected, but you know what I mean? Put my daughters into a Harry Potter book or whatever and see what would come out the other end. That's really fun, actually. I like that.
Yeah.
I think this conversation is often a little bit fraught, and instead talking about what's going to bring joy, what's going to be unlocked by this is much more, frankly, entertaining to me. Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, some authors are excited about this idea that their readers can like personalize the book, or they can use AI to change the ending or that kind of stuff. And some authors are not excited about it. So we're basically working with the authors who are excited and who want to kind of pioneer this. And I think that once we build out the framework for this, it's actually happening. I think all authors will come on board eventually. But it's just, it's a pretty big step forward for the world of content creators. So we're trying to just take it one step at a time here.
I'm writing a book right now for fun, to be clear, but I'm writing it as a purely creative exercise. I do not expect whatever I publish in book format is going to make me more than like lunch. But if I wrote something that was useful to an AI model, I had a whole different monetization stream. That would honestly encourage me to do more of it. And so instead of worrying about AI, if there's money here, I think this sort of setup could actually encourage more human creative output net, which is good for the species, the planet, and hopefully our future. That's why I'm optimistic here, if that makes sense, Trip.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the past, books are always written to be read by other humans. And there's now this future where robots are going to be reading books too. And you could potentially have a hit book that was never read by humans, but was really popular with all the AIs, right? Like we could be entering, or we will be entering a world like that. So who knows? Maybe your book will be a robot hit.
I really doubt it, given that it's kind of schlocky, tropey fantasy type stuff. So I don't think it's going to be that helpful. But I brought up the whole human creativity point because you guys have a very interesting part of your kind of like corporate manifesto. And for those who are not watching the video version, I'm going to read this. And I pulled this from the site. Building upon Isaac Asimov's three laws of robotics, we have developed and are advocating for a new constitution. And the first point of this is, quote, the fourth law, which you describe as, when AI robots use or learn from human behavior or human creative output, this must happen symbiotically to benefit both humans and robots. So first of all, I take it you're an Asimov fan.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Me too. So I saw this and I was like, ah. And if you don't know the three laws of robotics, look them up. There's also the zeroth law if you want to get super technical about it. But here, you're essentially saying that when AIs take from humans, there should be a symbiotic positive benefit to both sides. Which is interesting because how does the human stuff benefit the robots, which are non-living? Is that more like a quality of output point, or is that we're going to give them value too?
Yeah, so the way we came up with this was, we first wanted to solve this problem. We started talking to folks in the content industry and in the AI industry, and there was this big debate about whether training is fair use or not. And folks in the content industry were all saying, well, no, of course it's not fair use. This is copyright infringement. And then folks in the AI industry were saying that, because a human can read unlimited books and learn from those books, robots should also be able to read and learn from unlimited books. So they're just kind of like two fundamentally different views on this matter, which was leading to all the lawsuits. So we wanted to try to kind of come up with a new philosophy to bridge these two perspectives. We're trying to like bring everyone together here. So the way we bridge these two sides is we looked at what Asimov had said, which is that there should be certain rules that describe human robot relations, that we need special rules as it relates to how robots learn from humans and train on their data. That's a perspective that basically everyone in the content world and the AI world basically can agree on. And then from there, we're able to kind of build the company around this philosophy.
Okay. That helps a lot. I'm going to pull this back up and I'm going to translate this to my understanding of it now. So I would say, and I'm just riffing here, I'm not trying to be critical of your, corporate verbiage, but when AI robots use or learn from human behavior or human creative output, humans get to say yes or no, and the human is compensated for helping the robot, is another way of saying that.
Yeah, it's another way of saying it. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I just want to make sure that I fully got that, because if we're doing science fiction references, I have to go all the way to the bone to understand what we're talking about. There's another thing you guys are working on that I thought was super cool, which is almost like a favicon or like an icon. And you want to give people a way to demonstrate that something that they've built is done by humans versus AI. And you had this little icon, a bit like the copyright symbol. What was the reason behind this?
We imagine that being the new copyright symbol. We think what might be even more powerful than copyright in the future is this idea that something is created by humans versus then by AI. So the idea is this symbol is, you could put this on your book or whatever human creation you have to indicate that it was created by humans and not by robots. And, we as a company believe that, human creativity is invaluable and we want to make sure it is protected in the AI era. But at the same time, we don't want it, siloed off from the world of AI. And that's why we're trying to, get this working relationship going between human creativity and AI. And that's really the broader mission of the company.
Well, then I think we probably need three then. We need one that's pure human, one that's augmented. Like, I don't know, if I use Grammarly to edit something to help me find a missing comma, I don't think I'm writing with AI, but AI is helping me write. And then we probably need a third one that's just like, a robot wrote this, just so you know. Because it feels weird to only mark off one section of writing as a thing and then not categorize the other areas of work. Or am I being overly pedantic here?
No, I think you're right. Yeah, I think we probably should create multiple badges. It's a good idea. Maybe we'll work with that. Like I said, we're just getting started. So that was our first approach, but we'll build on that.
So just before I let you go, a final question about synthetic data, because you and I are talking about really the most handcrafted artisanal words that you can think of, books, which are a big labor of love by both authors and editors and publishers and so forth. But I've also heard about synthetic data becoming increasingly important in LLM training. Does that represent a risk to the underlying thesis of the company? Or do you think that even in a synthetic data positive era, we're still going to absolutely need to pull from the great human library?
Yeah, so this is the question that I ask everyone in the AI community, like where they think this is going between synthetic data and AI and human data, just because it is like a core question to this for how this company is gonna work.
When I talk to portfolio founders about what's slowing them down, they always vent to me about project management. Juggling hundreds of different projects is hard. If you're shipping a product or rolling out an update, you're building a company and you need to be organized. Well, Atlassian has exactly what you need to streamline your work and smash your goals. The Atlassian for Startups program is packed with the tools you need, like Jira to track every task, sprint, and bug, Confluence for team collaboration and documentation, and Loom for quick video explainer creation. We use Loom all the time inside of our organization to train new team members, to recap company pitches we have, and to just generally share when you're a remote team. So you also get Compass, Jira Product Discovery, Bitbucket, and more, all powered by Atlassian Intelligence. That's their built-in AI. Atlassian software helps companies like Canva, Cloudflare, and Rivian keep growing and innovating. So whether you're brainstorming on sticky notes or scaling to the big leagues, Atlassian is here to accelerate your startup growth. So here's your call to action. Very simple. Check out Atlassian for Startups, where eligible startups get up to 50 seats for free for 1 year. That's incredibly generous. I mean, it's a big number, 50 people. So head to Atlassian.com/startup/twist for complete details and eligibility. Again, that's Atlassian.com/startups/twist.
I haven't heard anyone say that human data is going to go away entirely. I mean, there's some people who are more enthusiastic about synthetic data, some are less. But the general consensus is going to be, it's going to be a mix of synthetic data and human data. And human data is going to be really important. Regardless of everyone's opinions, I mean, our company, we are built around this idea that human data is invaluable and it always will be. And I mean, that'll be true for a million years. There's still something fundamentally unique about humans, and that's what we need to protect and preserve in the AI era. Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out between synthetic data and human data. I mean, we'll be keeping a close eye on that. So if I ever, come back on the show in the future, I might have some, new thoughts to share on that.
Well, I'm glad you said if I come back on the show, because I was just thinking about what your next major newsy event might be that'll bring you on. Are you guys going to announce commercial deals with, like, for example, I'm just picking a random name out of a hat, OpenAI? Or are those agreements going to be quieter and not something that you'll make noise about as a company when they happen?
I think it's to be determined. And more likely, I mean, we're a pretty open, transparent company, so I think we would like to share these things. And we think it's better if we're, I mean, given the level of conflict and we're trying to improve things, we think that, you know, being more open about this is gonna lead to better outcomes. So I think we'll be pretty open as a company, but you know, we'll see. We'll see how it plays out.
All right. Well, we'll have you back on in maybe 6 months to see how the marketplace is growing. And I'm very curious to see where prices net out, because I don't think really anyone knows right now what the stuff is worth. And it'll also be very interesting to see down the road, maybe in 2 years' time, what fraction of author revenue generated by your platform is for model training versus RAG versus transformation, because each one of those to me could become the leading driver of demand, but I have no idea which one it's going to be, you know, given enough time for this to kind of mature. So thank you so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. This was great. And hope to come back sometime.
Before you go, where can people find both the company and yourself on the great wide internet?
Well, the company is just createdbyhumans.ai. Mm-hmm. So that's our URL. And as for me, you can find me there. You can find me on Twitter. Twitter's probably good. So
you mean the platform formerly known as Twitter now? X.com.
X.com. Yeah. I'm still getting used to that. But yeah, X, my Twitter handle is Trip Adler. You can find me there or follow Created by Humans too. So hope to see you there.
All right. Thank you, Trip. All right. Next, we're going to go into our Twist 500 bag and talk to the CEO and co-founder of Sila. If you don't know battery technology and why they matter to the modern world and are improving at a slow but perhaps accelerating rate, this is for you. Let's have some fun. Did you know that the Nobel Prize in Chemistry back in 2019 was awarded to three people, John B. Goodenough, M. Stanley Whittingham, and Akira Yoshino, for their contributions to the lithium-ion battery? It was actually just back in 1991 that the first lithium-ion battery was used in kind of an everyday consumer electronic. We're very accustomed to lithium-ion batteries today, and you could actually argue that they have made the modern electronic world possible in a great many ways, especially in mobile. but they're actually still relatively new, and they have been getting better over time. But as the entire world begins to think more about lower carbon energy, renewable energy, and energy storage, we're going to need to take our current battery technology and make it quite a lot better. So there's still work to do. And that's why companies like Sila, I think, are particularly interesting, because they are trying to take the humble batteries that we know and love today and squeeze more out of them so we can go further, faster, and in more comfort. So please welcome to the show, it's Gene Bernashevsky. He's the co-founder and CEO over at Sila. Gene, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Alex.
So prepping for today's show, I'm not a chemist, nor a physicist, nor an electrical engineer. I am a big old fan of technology that's going to make my life better. And I think that's you. But I do want to start with some basics. So prepping, pretty clear that Titan silicon anodes inside of batteries is what Sila is working on today. Those are a number of words that I think most folks listening don't understand. So could you start with just explaining to folks out there what you guys have built and how it's making batteries have more energy density today?
Yeah, let's break it down. Maybe let's just start at your cell phone or your electric car. And inside of one of those, you've got a battery cell. Now, everybody sort of thinks about that and says, okay, that stores energy, but very, very few people ever take one apart. If you take one apart, there are two really important components in there. One is the anode that stores lithium when the battery is charged. The other is the cathode that stores lithium when the battery is discharged. Those two components take up probably 80, 90% of the space inside the battery. At Sila, we make one of those components. We make the anode. And the anode we make, Titan silicon, is about half the size and about five times lighter than the anode that's in your battery today. And it doesn't matter if it's in your car or your phone. Ours is dramatically better. And so as we integrate our anode material into these batteries, they shrink or they can store more energy. So that's what we do. The actual material, the actual anode, is a black powder. You know, we sometimes talk about it as black magic dust. It's really, fine powder. And it goes into the front end of a gigafactory where your battery cell is assembled.
And this it's a nanoparticle, I think, technically, by the size of the actual materials that are used, correct?
So our materials are actually micron sized, but they have nanoscale features in order to make the technology work. It's one of the sort of critical things. It's why, this technology that we're bringing to market, scientists have been working on silicon anodes for 20 plus years, and no one's ever cracked the code. And we actually went through about 100,000 iterations synthesizing different materials with different compositions and different features. And once we got that right, it was through a critical set of kind of nano properties that made it work that we're able to commercialize this.
Actually, I read that number as 80,000 when I was prepping. I was going to bring it up. I'm glad to know that it's actually now into the 100,000 realm. But it reminds me a little bit of what Edison did with light bulb filaments, trying to figure out what would work. I mean, admittedly, I don't think he ran 100,000 tests like you guys did. But, there's a history in electrification of just straight up experimenting until we find the right material. Now, when it comes to this Titan silicon, which is how you've branded it, you've said that you're looking at today at about a 20% energy density boost, and you're hoping for, I think, up to 40% in the future. So first of all, how impactful is 20%, and how far from doubling that is Sila today?
So 20% is a massive amount at the chemistry level. What the chemistry that's in your phone today started plateauing, probably finished plateauing right around 2008, 2010. Hasn't really improved. And every little percentage point that's been squeezed out, any kind of phone runtime improvements or laptop runtime improvements, those you can really attribute to the improvements in microchips, not the battery, certainly not the battery chemistry. Today, chemistry improves maybe 1% per year. So think of this as like two to four decades worth of breakthroughs. I mean, this is as significant a chemistry change as when we went from nickel metal hydride to lithium ion in the first place. It's as big a deal. And so it's a really big deal in the business. As far as getting from 20 to 40%, we think kind of end of the decade is a reasonable time frame for that. So once you kind of unlock this new chemistry, you can pretty quickly advance it as long as you have the investment in R&D to kind of continue to push it forward. So we feel pretty good about that.
Okay. You did a Reddit AMA recently, which was actually very, very interesting. And one question I was going to ask you was, why just 20%? Because I'm so spoiled to processors getting, you know, much faster, very, very rapidly. I mean, Moore's law has been fantastic for a very long time. And just thinking about the software side of AI models today, I mean, it really feels like it was such quick progress. But you explained to people on Reddit why this is hard. And you said batteries are a mix of every engineering and scientific discipline all going on at once, materials, chemistry, physics, mechanics, and quantum. And then you have to scale it up. But you also said something that's really interesting, which is, you know, often in batteries, you can improve one thing and make other things worse at the same time. So it sounds like you found a way to increase density, but just going on your own argument, has there been any downsides to moving to the Titan silicon anodes that might make it less exciting than it sounds on paper?
So that's what we spent a decade in order to be able to say no.
Nice. Right?
So there are no downsides. As a matter of fact, there's one other upside, which is you can recharge batteries with Titan silicon in about half the time of conventional batteries. So you can get much faster boost. The periodic table of elements is actually just quite small. And when you're talking about storing more energy, you're really talking about driving the voltage further apart, and there's only so much more you can do there, and going to smaller and smaller atoms, smaller and smaller elements. And we're already at lithium, which is one of the smallest. So really from here, in terms of batteries, there's maybe a 2x improvement from today's state of the art on a volume basis. And that's kind of it. That's as far as we can see today. So unlike AI or unlike microchips, you know, we're not dealing in information, we're dealing in energy, and we're bound by the laws of thermodynamics and what the universe gave us.
So if we're at a 20% boost today, 40% by the end of the decade, how long would it take us to reach that theoretical doubling that you mentioned?
I think it depends on the investment in R&D. I think, you know, you could probably do it in sometime in the 2030s. You need to improve the cathode as well, separator, a couple other things, but it's doable. And that's at the chemistry level. People are also optimizing the packaging and things like that. So maybe there's a 2.5x from where we are today. But that 2.5x would transform life as we know it. I mean, every single vehicle would be electric. You know, on a weight basis, you might be able to get 3 or 4x. You know, airplanes would become electric for regional flights. So you would transform the face of the planet as far as energy is concerned with those kind of improvements.
That's why I wanted to start with pointing out that lithium ion batteries are relatively new, and they made, you know, the Discmans that I used as a child, and then my first cell phone, and then my first iPhone, and then like all this stuff is made possible by this relatively humble battery chemistry that we've now been using for 35 years, give or take. But it sounds like we're not on the cusp of a similar revolution per se. We're just going to be improving the lithium ion batteries. I feel like you're about to jump in, so go for it.
Yeah. So there's a little nuance. So the energy is carried by the lithium ion itself, but what it's doing, the key thing is how are you storing those lithium ions? How densely can you store them? And so when you say traditional lithium ion, what you're really saying is you have an anode made of graphite, which has been the dominant anode for 33 years now, and you have a cathode made typically of a metal oxide, lithium cobalt oxide, nickel oxide. You kind of hear NCM, LFP, LCO, those kind of terms. Mm-hmm. Those materials are the host materials, and what we're doing is replacing graphite with silicon, and then over time we'll replace the cathode with something else as well. And again, we're not really just improving lithium ion per se. Those are complete chemistry revolutions. You might as well call today's lithium ion, you know, graphite, nickel graphite batteries. And what we're doing is going to nickel silicon batteries. These are really big changes that are not, you're not squeezing the chemistry. You're having to kind of unlock a whole nother dimension of science.
That makes so much more sense to me, because I was going through a lot of just, you know, background material on the industry, and it felt like you guys were making at least like lithium silicon batteries. I wasn't quite sure what to call them per se, but I think people best understand lithium ion as kind of a starting point today for battery tech.
Yeah.
Now, on the point about the Titan silicon anodes, one reason why I'm excited about Sila is that it seems that you can take this technology you guys have built and put it into a host of batteries today, and essentially unlock this performance improvement that we discussed across form factors, sizes, implementations. Is that a fair understanding of what you've built?
100%. So you got it. So the reason this revolution feels like evolution sometimes is I call it a revolution in parts, meaning we drop in this new component, but we put it into the existing gigafactories, and that's by design. It's actually much harder to create a new technology that's fully compatible with everything downstream, right? you don't have the privilege, you don't have the advantage of saying, well, if I just make the battery a little differently, then I can use this new chemistry.
Right.
So we're making all the components that we want to revolutionize. We want them to be compatible with existing gigafactories. And what that means is it can go into any form factor, any application, any factory anywhere in the world today. Mm-hmm. And the same materials that we're now shipping in consumer devices, we're in you know, several million products around the world today. Those same materials are the ones that we're scaling up to put into your electric vehicles. And there's, you know, very little we have to do differently, and there's very little the customer has to do differently.
So I want to put this into very, very easy to understand consumer terms. I recently went out and finally replaced my iPhone 11. I got a 16. It's fine. But how long until I see, you know, Sila's battery technology in a device that I can go purchase at the mall? And I know you've had money from Mercedes-Benz. I think you worked with BMW. I think Panasonic was in there at some point. But when can I go out and kind of like experience this?
So you can experience it today. The one product that we're in that I can publicly say is the Whoop fitness tracker. So if you use a Whoop product, you use one of the most advanced batteries in the world today. And I say one of, because we're also in another device that I unfortunately can't publicly say. But, like I said, millions of people are using our product today. As far as a cell phone, it probably 1 to 2 years from now. So we're in the process of building our sort of first gigafactory, if you will, really a single digit gigawatt hours facility in Washington State. And, you know, that'll be enough for kind of tens of thousands of cars. So we'll get into a few vehicles that you'll be able to buy at the high end. But it's also enough for hundreds of millions of cell phones, or as many as a billion wearable devices. So we'll be sort of all over consumer electronics in the next couple of years.
How hard is it to like set up this first single digit gigawatt hour factory? And then how much of that's replicable across the facility? As in, are you doing all the hard learning now to manufacture at scale, and it'll be easier to continue that process as you go through?
It's insanely hard. It's several hundred million dollar investment. First of a kind. Everything is new. Everything is different. There's no one you can turn to and say, well, how did you do it last time? In many ways, the organization is learning how to build these large projects. And so, as we expand, that'll be more like billion-dollar scale investments. We'll be mm-hmm. ready for that. I think where we are in our journey, we're shipping commercially today from Alameda.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how we got into the millions of devices. This is kind of like our Model S, if you will. It's kind of our second go around. It's a lot better, but it's dramatically harder. You know, the Roadster was kind of hand-built. The Model S was like a whole, modern car. And then as we kind of go to the full scale, what I call world scale reactor sizes in the next cycle, a few years down the line, that's kind of like the Model 3 equivalent. So we're kind of in the middle of our scaling journey. I think it'll take us, another 4 years before I can say we're a world class, materials and chemistry company on the likes of a BASF or a Umicore or Corning.
I was going to ask about applications, because when I think of lithium ion batteries, two things come to mind: consumer electronics and electric vehicles, right? But we also talk a lot about just like grid load capacity size batteries. And I know that there's different chemistries you can use for those because they don't need to cycle as often and they don't have weight problems and they can be huge because who cares? But I'm curious what Sila's technology could do to increasing our ability as a species to store energy so that we can move faster towards a renewable future.
So ultimately we will address that market. It has a lot higher cost pressure than even the auto market. And the auto market is notoriously cost sensitive. So you kind of think about it as you bring a new technology into the world, you really want to start at the high end. Uh-huh. And so that's us enabling you to have your phone run 20% longer, 30% longer. I mean, that's worth a lot, right? And there's like 10 cents of graphite anode in the battery in your phone that we would replace. And so you tell me, is it worth $5 or $10 to have 30% longer runtime?
Actually, I'm curious about that, because if the graphite costs 10 cents, it's essentially free, even for an iPhone bill of sales, right?
That's right.
What does a similar battery equipped with Titan silicon cost? What's the differential there from the relatively cheap graphite?
Couple bucks difference, right? Like almost free from a consumer standpoint, right? But
so in terms of percentage difference, it's quite high, but it only scales up to a Big Mac, so it's just not that big of a deal.
Correct. Not even a Big Mac, right? It's like
the inflation
prices of a Big Mac today.
Yeah, half a Big Mac.
And That's right. And by the way, you know, faster recharge. And the reason, by the way, when you got your iPhone 16 and you start playing with, you're like, yeah, this is a lot like the 13 I just had. I just went through this upgrade. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons is that the processor speed is throttled in order to get you the battery lifetime you want. So what you're going to experience it like is it's going to be a way snappier phone when you can unthrottle some of the processor speed. And that's something all of us techies love, right? Yes. We love snappy, snappy, snappy. So I think I'm optimistic, as well as AI features. Those are very power hungry. So if you want AI at the edge, you're going to want these kind of batteries. And we're seeing that. We're seeing customers excited for this. You know, they're not worried about, you know, a couple bucks on a device like that.
I'm disappointed though that we were already kind of running up against the limits of chemistry. So those feel very immovable. Like, okay, hear me out. I'm an idiot, but like lithium is the lightest solid.
It's one of the lightest. I think that's right. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Cause that doesn't give you a lot more space. There's not like three things that are lighter that we could try that are also solids. Do you think that we need something a bit more radical in how we think about storing electricity, and that maybe that the current method we've been running with for so long is just insufficient to meet our future storage needs?
Not really. I think we underappreciate just how insanely cheap energy is and how much. When you think about the grid, I mean, our whole society is based on this. And if you make the foundation of an entire, you know, Salesforce Tower level skyscraper, which is, you know, you can think of all of our technology stack, is sitting on the foundation of energy. If you improve that foundation 20-30% and you can build 20-30% higher or whatnot, you know, you think about the technology levels you can reach. I mean, lithium ion itself, when in 2003, when GM crushed the EV1, they basically said, look, the batteries are just not good enough. And literally that year, or 2001, they crushed it. And literally the next year, Tesla was incorporated because lithium-ion batteries had gotten good enough. And that was only, you know, at that point, maybe a 50% improvement in batteries, right? And then it kept going. First, we're going to focus on mobile consumer devices. We're going to enable new kinds of AI devices that you've never seen before. I have some really cool customers that I can't even tell you what they're working on, but like we're helping the customers at the leading edge of AI sort of push devices that are going to be coming to market in the next couple of years. We're also going to support drones, some of these aerial vehicles, some of these eVTOL type vehicles, right? So you can change society with a 2x better battery. When you talk about the grid, it's so cost sensitive. We'll get there. We will lower the cost of energy storage as well. And the reason we do that is the more energy you can store in a single cell, the fewer cells you can use to make a pack. So if you use half as many cells, you're mining half as much material, you're processing half as much material, you know, it costs you half as much to put on the grid. But a lot of that is, you know, there's regulatory reasons why it costs as much as it does. There's sort of, it's not the fundamentals of energy are incredibly cheap, which is also what makes it really hard to compete. It's why you have to, you know, invest $1 billion in R&D to get something that's better than what's out there in the world, because our whole society is built on it, and it's really hard to wring even 1% out of these things.
Well, I'm really glad that you're going to get 20%. That I've never been so excited about 20% in my life. I feel like
love it.
It's going to unlock so much. But when I think about the placement of Sila in the market today, what we need as a society and what we're kind of focusing on, which is like hard tech and getting back to building things, to me, it seems like where your company is, money should just be like raining down in huge bricks from the sky to land on your HQ in Alameda. You guys have raised, I think, $1.4 billion. That's publicly known. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to do what you're doing. But one way companies used to raise money was going public. They would go public and raise money. And that's gone out of fashion as more private capital has become available. But I'm curious about you guys and if an IPO might be a fundraising mechanism for you versus a future eventual corporate capstone moment.
It's fair. I mean, I think whenever we go public, the proceeds would be used to expand production capacity because that's how our business runs. The question is sort of how much production capacity, how much revenue, what kind of economics do we need in order for the street to kind of believe in us and bet on us for the next thing? And I think we're not quite there, but certainly, you know, hopefully in the next few years, we'll get to a point where that makes sense. I think we access to public markets is really important for industrial companies like ours because it brings down the cost of capital, right? It allows us to get debt, bank debt, just a much bigger pool of capital gets to rush in. So, you know, obviously we're going to wait, you know, we're going to need others that have very strong economics to lead the way. And I'm surprised a lot of those aren't, you know, yet in the market, but, you know, hopefully that creates some tailwinds for folks like us to be able to raise additional capital and grow our business.
So you've made it very, very clear that doing what you're doing is difficult. Versus today, it feels like making software is the easiest it's ever been to get on that train and start making something. So could you, just as a closing riff here, pitch founders to go out and build physical things that are hard versus software things that are easier?
Look, I think most founders don't want to do things that are easy. That's not how we're wired. You know, for me, going into battery chemistry, I was at Tesla. I was working on the battery systems. We made amazing progress, unlocked this whole wave of electrification. My question was, as I decided to do my own thing, was what's even harder than that? And I found chemistry and physics and sort of what we're doing now. And it's incredibly satisfying to solve insanely hard problems. And, you know, look, startups are supposed to be risky.
Yes.
Odds are it's not going to work. So you want to be working on something that you're going to be satisfied with, even if the outcome isn't exactly what you envision. You're going to want to be satisfied that you are in the, you know, in the arena, in the proverbial arena, you know, fighting a fight you really care to fight. And, you know, to me, there's not a lot of things more important than, you know, changing the foundation of society and energy and having the opportunity to kind of rebuild the U.S. industrial base. I mean, to me, those two things are incredibly motivating every morning.
Well, if you don't have a reason to get out of bed, you can just stay in bed and drink wine. So I'm glad that you're working on this. And I'm really excited to eventually learn what that second device is that's currently using your technology and also getting it into my iPhone. So if you don't mind, call up Cupertino and tell them to get off their backsides and make a better phone. I'd appreciate it. All right, Gene, for folks who want to take another look at the company, what is the website?
www.sila.com.
All right. Thank you very much, my friend. We'll talk to you in maybe a year, see how things are going. When that factory opens up, take a video and send it to us. We'd love to show it on the show.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me, Alex.
Thank you. All right. And then to close out today, Netflix. Netflix is, of course, the consumer streaming giant. It dropped earnings because we are now just getting into the Q4 calendar earnings cycle. So expect to hear a lot more in the next couple of weeks from both major technology companies all the way down to your smaller public firms. But Netflix had an absolutely boko, insane quarter, and Wall Street is cheering. So why is Netflix up 11% today? Well, it's because they added 18.9 million subscribers in the last quarter, bringing them to over 300 million, about 302 million subscribers on a global basis. That was better than Wall Street expected. And the company dropped a $15 billion stock buyback while also boosting its outlook. So I'm not going to lie, this has been a pretty smashing quarter for Netflix, a company that saw its value dramatically come down, a couple years back. Its rebound has been honestly pretty legendary. And if you read the company's official IR documents, they talk about how they have a number of hit shows coming out this year, or sorry, sequential seasons from hit shows. So they're pretty optimistic about 2025 calendar for the business. A lot of people thought that after COVID came and really helped a lot of companies grow, they pulled forward so much growth early that they were going to have just kind of pathetic growth rates for the foreseeable future. Just hasn't really turned out to be the case in Netflix. So if you sold back when Netflix was what, $250 a share, and now you're sad that it's about $1,000 a share, well, sometimes patience really is a virtue. Get ready for a lot more earnings reports. We're going to cover just the absolute biggest ones here on Twist, the ones that matter the most. For example, if Microsoft talks about OpenAI a lot in its earnings calls coming up, well, we will bring that to you, but we're not going to break down every single, I don't know, line item from Cloudflare's own earnings reports. But that is Twist for today, my friends. Jason will be healed up, hopefully, and back with us on Friday. More interviews to come. And don't forget to check out thisweekinstartups.com/docket if you want to see the information we put together for each show. We're making sure that goes out about an hour or two before we record, so you can chime in, frankly. You can drop a comment if you want. And also twist500.com. That's where we're building the list of the 500 most interesting and potentially lucrative private market companies. My name is Alex. We'll see you soon. Bye.